Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and all things lifestyle. I'm Renee Bodley, filling in for Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Dave Cushing. Today, we will first speak with Dr. Stuart Shanker, a Canadian psychologist whose new book might help you help your kids manage the stress that's coming at them from multiple directions, especially in our hectic, overscheduled digital age.
And we need to learn how to live with stress right now, Dave, don't we? Because we're waiting for a phone call to come in that is supposed to be here. So stay tuned, folks.
So
hopefully
true.
That phone will ring. Then after we speak with Dr. Shanker, we're going to talk to Tracy Powers. She's the owner of Range, a Park City-based health and fitness center. We're going to chat with Tracy about the benefits of practicing Pilates and also about an exercise technique called gyrotonic, Dave.
Right.
Sounds complicated. Which advocates say helps increase your range of motion, strength, flexibility, and creates articulation of the joints. That's interesting.
Super interesting, Renee. Well, folks, this is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
Hi, this is Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. This summer, Park City Mountain offers a variety of events for the whole family, including the annual July 4th celebration and fireworks, summer concert series, and weekly Wednesday Farmers Market. The full calendar of Park City Mountain events is available at parkcitymountain.com.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, proud KPCW sponsor of The Mountain Life. Are you reluctant or worried about having a total knee or shoulder replacement? We offer an array of non-surgical and surgical alternatives. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. The time is 9:09. I'm Renee Bodley filling in for Lynn Ware Peak, and Dave Cushing's my co-host. Good morning, Dave.
Hey, Renee.
We're going to check out the weather while we're waiting for Dr. Shanker to call. Right now it's 57 degrees. We're looking for a high of 82 today. Supposed to have some isolated showers and thunderstorms after noon. Did you get any rain where you were last night, Dave?
No rain here in Old Town.
Yeah, there were some dark skies for a while, but didn't see any raindrops falling. Tonight, we're going to have a low of 52 with a 20% chance of isolated thunderstorms. Then Thursday, tomorrow, high of 84. Friday, high of 86. Saturday and Sunday in the high 80s. So it's getting toasty out there.
Right. When Dr. Shanker checks in, we'll be talking about his book on helping your child manage stress. Speaking of stress, if you're coming into Old Town today, there's a lot of paving going on, and you might be rerouted, especially around Swede Alley and Kimball and Main Street. So keep an eye out for that.
Another traffic hiccup this morning as I was driving in on 224 from Sun Peak. The lights at Sun Peak and Old Ranch Road and 224 were out, and so they were flashing red, so you had to treat it as a four-way stop. Lots of people trying to get into town around 8:30. And it was backing up big time on 224 because of that. Hopefully that is fixed now. Any other traffic updates we need to give people?
How about some mountain trails updates? I was up yesterday way up on Pinecone Ridge. It was super beautiful and you could see forever.
That's nice. It's a good time to get out there mountain biking. We just got the thumbs up from Ethel and Bob, our producer. We are ready to go with Dr. Stuart Shanker. He's a distinguished research professor of psychology and philosophy at York University in Toronto, a past president of the Council on Early Child Development. Dr. Shanker has been an advisor on this topic to government organizations across Canada and the U.S. Just last week, hot off the presses, folks, he published his latest book, Self-Reg, How to Help Your Child and You Break the Stress Cycle and Successfully Engage with Life. Welcome to The Mountain Life, Dr. Shanker.
Thank you very much, Renee.
Hey, I love the title of your book, Dr. Shanker, because it says exactly what it is, helping your child and you brace the stress cycle. It's a fantastic title. So let's start with that stress cycle. What does it look like?
Didn't start with an easy question, did you, Dave?
No, but right. And I know it changes as a child ages, right?
Yes, it does. Okay, so can I give you a two-part answer?
Absolutely.
Okay, the first part is understanding what a stress is. And this is not actually well understood. So for scientists, A stress is anything that requires us to burn energy in order to keep some system running smoothly. And the classic example the founder of this theory gave was cold weather. Cold is a stressor because all these things go on to keep our body temperature at 98.6. It's an important example because when we start to look at a stress cycle, we look at five domains. We look at the physical domain, not just temperature, but things like the amount of visual or auditory stimulus. We look at smells, crowds. These are all stresses. The next domain is emotion. Then we look at cognitive stress, the stress of school. And the last two are social and pro-social. Pro-social is the stress of somebody else's distress. The reason why this is so important is twofold. The first is it's never just a case of a kid struggling with one stress. And there's usually one stress that sticks out, and we think, well, that's the problem. But in fact, what we've seen is it's always all five domains that are involved. And when a child's overstressed because of these underlying stresses, then maybe something like an exam is what tips the kid over. But it's not just that cognitive stress that's the issue. It's always all five. So what that tells us is, first, to break a stress cycle, we have to look at all five. And second, the parent is also a part of this stress cycle. My stress is exacerbated by my child's, which in turn exacerbates mine. So to break a stress cycle is to break it in the family, in the school. It's not just picking out the one thing that stands out in that child's behavior.
And Dr. Shankar, you start your book with a pretty compelling story. And in fact, it's a story that you said made you decide to write this book about how figuring out how to resolve one child's stress can impact an entire community. Can you talk about that story, please?
Well, it is, in fact, the reason why I decided to write this. I had been giving a lecture to several thousand primary school teachers in Ontario. And I was explaining why there's no such thing as a bad kid. And a little voice pops up from the back of the hall. She was standing up, and she said, "I got a bad kid. And his dad was a bad guy, and his grandfather was a bad guy." So everybody starts to laugh. But, you know, I was thinking, well, I'd like to meet this kid. And, you know, maybe I'm wrong, or maybe there's something for me to learn. So we arranged for us to meet him. And in that meeting, I was sitting waiting for the child. And he was 7 years old, and the teacher was beside me, and they brought the kid in, and you could tell he'd been scared even before he came into the office. They'd obviously told him he was going to meet the doctor. But what I noticed about him was a couple of things. The first one was that he startled twice by noises in the hall. And the other thing that I noticed was he was squinting, which is the sign that that visual stimuli are a stress for this particular child. So what I did was I closed the door, I turned off the desktop computer, and just created this sort of quiet environment. And the kid did something magical. He smiled. Now, for us, that's huge. That smile tells us that this child, that stress has come way down. But the more important part was I heard the teacher beside me say under her breath, "Oh my God." In that moment, she had suddenly seen a different child. She hadn't just seen him differently. She saw a kid that was struggling to manage in life, but because of his biology, he found things stressful that other kids didn't. And now we could start to figure out strategies not just to reduce this child's stress, but most important of all, teach him how to do it for himself so that when he went on in life and encountered new stresses, he would have this knowledge, this understanding of himself, of when he was becoming overstressed, that would enable him to deal much more adaptively, much more constructively with the new stresses in his life.
That's super interesting. Do you think the incident of the sorts of stresses and stressors you're talking about have increased in the last 30 to 40 years? And if so, how?
So, Dave, that is really, really a tough question, right?
Yeah,
because,
right. How is it measured?
You know, we don't have these kinds of, there have been some studies trying to do this, but we do have one metric that we go by. What we've been charting in Canada and the U.S. over the last, since the year 2000, the last 17 years, is the rise of stress-related problems. So these could be problems in behavior, in attention, in mood, in mental health, physical health. And what we've seen is not just that these problems keep on, that the number of kids with these problems keep on growing, they are growing at an explosive pace. So to give you one example, we did a big study here in Toronto a couple of years ago, and almost three-quarters of the teenagers and middle school kids were reporting serious problems with anxiety. And we see this everywhere. So what all this is telling us is that there is something different today. And what we had to figure out is what are the sources of these stress, and then most important of all is if I see stress behaviors in my child, stress behavior as opposed to misbehavior, I have to know this difference. Then I've got to figure out what do I do? Are there things I can do to not just counteract the stress, but really teach my child or my teenager how to do this on their own?
How do you recognize the difference between stressed behavior and misbehavior?
So, Renee, that's the million-dollar question, right? And so we go into the book in quite some depth, and there are all kinds of signs of when it's a stress behavior. And sometimes those signs can simply be a big increase in my child's impulsivity or my child's inability to pay attention. But there are also very subtle signs. So I'll give you a great example. I have a 15-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl, and when my son is overstressed, his voice changes. I can hear through the pitch change, his voice goes up in pitch, that he is overstressed. So this is a sign that's kind of common in many teenagers. In my daughter, what happens is she suddenly fixates on, she has to rearrange her room, and it becomes urgent. Each child has their own sort of unique signs, and each child has a number of what we call physiological indicators that this is a stress behavior, not a conscious misbehavior. So we have to learn to read those signs and then respond accordingly.
Dr. Shanker, I really liked how the book was organized with a lot of chapter subheadings that leave the reader with just a page or two to get the point. I thought that was super. And you've got such great topics like, win at all costs. Is it too high a cost?
Yeah.
Marshmallows to meltdowns and the teenage gas guzzler. Could you talk about that teenage gas guzzling metaphor a little bit, please?
Yeah. Well, one of the problems that we have with teenagers today, so we're seeing really just this extraordinary bump in stress-related problems in, say, mood or in risky behavior, things like that. And what's happening here is, if you go back to what I was saying at the beginning about what a stress is, if the kid is under way too much stress, and those stresses might be hidden stresses. They might be things that the kid's doing that we don't even see as a stress. Can I give you an example of a hidden stress?
Yeah, please.
Okay, so here's a good one for teenagers. What we're seeing is a generation now that doesn't like to drink water anymore. And so what they're drinking are primarily sweetened drinks of one sort and another. The problem is that sugar is in fact a hidden stress if there's too much in the bloodstream. And I say that because we now know that too much sugar can actually cause cellular damage in the brain. So there's a system deep inside the brain that has to get rid of that extra sugar, and it will be doing this while that kid is asleep. And the problem is, the way it does it, you know, by producing insulin, this is very energy expensive. The child, even though that kid is sleeping, is burning all sorts of energy just to get his sugar levels back down to safe. When we look at teens and the things that they're doing, what we find is a lot of these activities are burning enormous amounts of energy, even when the kid's not, even when the kid is asleep. So, for example, there's a huge study that we talk about. They showed that if a kid plays a violent video game just before they turn off the lights, there's a system, an alarm system in the brain that stays on hyper alert, and that kid is burning unbelievable amounts of energy while he is sleeping. Our problem then is the next morning I've got this kid who wakes up and the kid is incredibly crabby. The kid can't pay attention, can't focus. And I'm seeing all of those signs. If you go back to Renee's very first question today, those signs that this kid is overstressed, but he's overstressed because the gas tank is empty. So what we've got to do with this kid is we've got to figure out why is the gas tank empty, and then most important of all is that kid has to learn it. That kid has to learn to recognize the signs of when his red lights come on his fuel gauge and what he needs to do in order to refill the tank so that, and this is the last thing I'll say here, so that he can embrace those positive stresses that will lead to a happy, successful life. Positive stresses like school, like athletics, music, even positive stresses like hanging out with friends, face-to-face hanging out.
If the child wakes up with the gas tank empty before school, is there a way to cultivate techniques so that the school day is going to be okay, or do you have to wait till next week and grow this over time?
Yeah, there are ways. So, again, bear in mind that every kid is different. So what we want to do now is we have to figure out, are there things that will help that kid regulate himself while he's actually in class? What are the kinds of things? So what we've done in our self-reg, we have a self-reg school-based initiative that runs now throughout Canada. And so what we've learned is there are things that we can do in the classroom that will help that kid. So, for example, we have one throughout the province of Nova Scotia. They brought in these what are called spark bikes, stationary bikes. And what we've learned is that just a couple of minutes on the spark bike, maybe it's first thing in the morning or sometime around mid-morning, can really pick that kid up, can refuel. However, and there's a big however here, this doesn't work for all kids. So for some kids, the spark bike actually dysregulates them. So for some kids, what we have to learn is what works for my child. Sometimes it's something as simple as, I need a break from this. I need the school to understand that I need a break from this. I need a chance to be quiet. Sometimes one of the best things we've done, especially for younger kids, is we create these spaces at the back of the classroom with a large beanbag chair, and we use a foot massager. And what happens is that just having that chance to reduce my tension, to bring that tension level down, is enough to start to refill the tank. So there are all kinds of things we can do, and you got to read the book because I don't want to take away all the great secrets.
Well, the first tip for parents, it sounds like, Dr. Shanker, is to put your kid in an isolation chamber and slowly reintroduce them to various stressors so you can figure out which one is the trigger.
You know, what we want to do as parents is, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, the most important one for me would be learning how to distinguish between misbehavior and stress behavior. And the reason why this is so important is if I yell at my child when it's stress behavior, if I am exasperated, if I punish stress behavior, I can make things a lot worse for my kid. I've got to learn how to distinguish between positive stress and negative stress. Positive stress are things that really promote growth. So an example would be, say, exercise. It's a stress, but it's a good stress. But the negative stresses, the problem with them is something that Dave was talking about before, and that is that if there are too many negative stresses in my child's life, they use up all of the gas, And now he doesn't have enough left in the tank to really engage with and benefit from what should be positive stresses. So what we're going to try to do with our child is we're going to try to figure out day by day. And the reason I say day by day, what's a positive, what's a negative? The reason it's day by day is because your kid's going to change all the time. The stresses are going to change. Your child's reaction to the stresses are going to change. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to read those signs. It's that ability to read the signs in the child or in myself that enabled me to respond and to teach my kid how to do it. Because, and this is critical, I don't know what the stresses are going to be that my son's going to have to confront in the next 10 years. The only thing I know is they are stresses that I cannot envisage. I can't anticipate. They're going to be new stresses, big stresses. So what I have to do is I have to give him these tools, these self-reg tools, so that he can respond constructively to the challenges that we know life is going to present.
Right. And then can you differentiate a little bit between the self-reg, self-regulation tools versus traditional self-control that you speak of not the way to really handle this situation?
Yeah, that's kind of like as important as the point that Renee raised. So this distinction between self-regulation and self-control is one of the most important things we explain in the book. Self-control is about inhibiting impulses. It's about making an effort to override these, to control those impulses. Self-regulation is about managing stress. These two systems are governed by very different parts of the brain. So when the child is in what we call a red brain state, when the child is in that hyper-aroused state, the systems that enable that child to exercise self-control go offline. So what we have to do is we have to bring that child back into blue brain. We have to shut down the alarm. We have to bring him back into that thinking, rational state. And what we find when we do this is that in most cases, either the child is now capable of exercising self-control, or what is more likely, there's no need to exercise self-control because the impulses themselves have diminished. So this is a fundamental distinction between what makes self-control possible and what makes self-control seemingly necessary. What we're trying to do is we're trying to teach the child how to recognize what are the things that are getting me into this state where I can't learn or I can't pay attention or I do worse on an exam than I know I could have done and so on.
And in the face of learning self-reg techniques, what about the can of worms called medication? Where does that fit in to the equation?
Well, our approach is basically we want to try to do this without medication as long as we can because, medication has side effects. But having said that, medication can be a real game changer for a child. For some children, that medication, what it does, and this is the key to your question, Dave, and why you call this a can of worms, medication makes it possible for some kids. It makes it possible for us now to learn self-reg. The mistake we make is if we see medication as itself the treatment, as itself, this is what's going to fix the kid. What medication does, in many cases, is it now makes it possible for us to begin to teach this child what are the stresses in your life. Now, what we're seeing is we are seeing very, very high levels of stress. So what we have to do with this kid, whether or not this is possible with or without medication, what is essential is the kid has to learn how to recognize for himself or herself when they are becoming overstressed. It's that preventative side. It's we call it going up an inverted V curve. When they're going up, we want them to know when they're going, when they're getting close to the peak, before they hit that peak, when only medication seems to be the only way to help them. It's learning to read those signs and knowing what's causing it and what to do. That's what's going to help this kid over the long run.
You also mentioned that there are some tricks parents use to calm or quiet kids, and how those tricks actually make it harder for children to calm down. What are some of those tricks? Is medication one of them?
It can be. You know, Renee, that's a real tough question, right? So all too often what we're doing is we may be suppressing the problem rather than addressing the problem. There are all kinds of ways that a parent suppresses a problem. So it could be medication. It could be yelling at the child. It could be sending the child on a timeout. It could be denying the child. One of the things that makes us crazy is when children are punished by denying them the one thing that they need, which might be, for example, exercise. So what we try to teach here is what parents have to learn is, has the child, every time there's these kinds of, let's call them explosive behaviors or explosive situations, these are learning opportunities. This is a chance for a child to learn how he can manage this himself. But he cannot learn this in that moment. In that moment, if you go back to what I was saying to Dave before, in that moment, if that blue brain has shut down, he's not learning anything. So what we have to do is we have to bring him back into that blue brain state. And you will get this opportunity to go through with the kid why this happened, what we could have done to prevent it. There are all kinds of incredibly important lessons for the child to learn, but only when he's capable of learning this. And one of the things that we've discovered is there's all kinds of ways that parents can have these sort of conversations. Sometimes a child... we have this one kid we were working with just a couple of weeks ago, and what mom discovered was it was through texting that she was able to get these ideas, these messages through, because the face-to-face seemed to make him freeze up. But when she texted it, then he was able to process what she was saying. So sometimes it's going on a walk together, going on a drive together. Those are the kinds of constructive tricks that we want parents to use to learn when their child is receptive and how they can capitalize on these moments to really help their child grow in terms of mastering self-reg.
Wow, that's an evolution in parenting, isn't it? I never heard someone say texting your child is actually the best way to parent.
I know, it's interesting, isn't it? That really made us all laugh, but you know what? I'm going to try it.
Got it. Well, I know that we're keeping you a little longer than we had promised, but it's just been so interesting. If I can end with just one last question. We have a lot of educators out there, a lot of parents involved in their kids' education. What is the one main stressor you're seeing in kids' education? Do you think they're being over-tested?
Renee, you didn't end on an easy question, did you?
Sorry.
Just like I didn't start with an easy one either.
No, you didn't. You guys have been tough. But they're great questions. Okay, so look, let's say that we're looking at something like an aptitude test, exams, all that. What we're really doing with something like an aptitude test or an IQ test or I can't remember what you call them in the States. We call them assessment testing up here.
Right.
So what we're looking at is where the child stops in comparison to their peers. And it's that stopping point that sort of we use to put the kid on a curve. But what's really going on here is very interesting. These tests are stress tests. They are disguised stress tests. And you have to read the book to understand that. But basically the point is a child stops when the stress is too great. And that stress may be emotional stress, or it could be the stress of the test itself, because the tests get increasingly difficult. But the thing is, the child stop, the reason why the child's stopping involves way more than just the test. It involves all five of those domains. And in fact, we've seen that we can, if I do things like look at the child's physical stress, I can significantly change the stopping point. I don't know how clear I'm making this, but it's important. Why is it important? Because the child's stopping point is really the point at which the kid's limbic brakes kick in. Limbic brakes are the systems deep inside the brain that stop the kid. They say, too much stress already, I got to stop. If I can figure out what the limbic brakes are, what the stresses are in my kid, and I can remove those brakes, I suddenly find I have no idea how far he can go on this test or she can go on this test, and that's our point. Our point is we never know what a child's potential is. But we jump to the conclusion that this kid only did such and such on the test, so this child's potential is only such and such. No, remove those breaks, remove the stresses, and you'll see a new kid. Just like in the story that I told Dave, she saw a new child. If I can remove the breaks as a teacher, as a parent educator, I suddenly find I have no idea what my child's potential is. And you know what? We never do. We never, ever know. So what we're trying to do with self-reg is really get rid of those breaks and let that kid fly. And we have this one image on our website that we use, and it looks like the child is flying. But it's a real great metaphor for never prejudging what a child's potential is, because you never know.
That is so fantastic, and we want to thank you for your generous time and for calling in today. It's Dr. Stuart Shanker, his new book, published last week, Self-Reg, How to Help Your Child and You Break the Stress Cycle and Successfully Engage with Life. He's gone now, and please stand by for a quick break, and we'll be right back with Tracy Powers from a local Pilates studio.
This is Damon Rogers, the new general manager of Park Meadows Country Club, proud sponsor of KPCW. I'm excited about the current clubhouse renovation, where we'll have expanded indoor-outdoor dining, mountain views, a new fitness center, and locker rooms coming this fall. More info at parkmeadowscc.com.
Support of KPCW comes from Zions Bank International Banking and Foreign Exchange Services. Zions Bank, we haven't forgotten who keeps us in business. More information available online at zionsbank.com.
Hi, I'm Renee Bodley, the new general manager of KPCW. For the fourth year in a row, the National Association of Broadcasters has named KPCW a finalist for the best non-commercial radio station of the year in America. KPCW belongs to you, our listeners. Thank you for helping us achieve excellence in broadcasting so we can serve Summit and Wasatch counties better.
Welcome back to This Mountain Life. I'm Renee Bodley, filling in for Lynn Ware Peak. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Cushing. We wanted to tell everybody about a backup that's happening on 224 right now. It's at the intersection of 224 and Sun Peak Road on one side and Old Ranch Road on the other side. And so when everyone's trying to get into town, it's creating a big backup that way and probably a big backup the other way, too. UDOT is aware. We don't have any word from them about when it will be fixed. So just be aware you're going to have to add some extra time to your trip in or out of town if you're going on 224. And our next guest was actually, I believe, caught in that situation. We're talking to Tracy Powers. She's with Range Pilates. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning.
How bad was the backup?
You know, it took some extra time, so just plan accordingly.
Yeah.
But I made it.
Good. Well, thank you for being here today. Let's tell our people a little bit about Pilates. Let's see. Practice developed by Joseph Pilates, German man born in the late 1800s, who overcame his sickly childhood to create the training and fitness regimen known by his name. Like yoga, people all over the world have found Pilates to be a beneficial way to keep their bodies and minds both flexible and strong. So how is Pilates different from yoga, Tracy?
I get asked that all the time. Yoga, I think of as a series of postures, and there's definitely different brands and spices of yoga available now. They both share a mind-body connection, but Pilates is more a series of exercises, It can be done on a mat without equipment, but we teach it with various equipments that Joseph Pilates developed and even some new things that have been developed after his passing. So you do get some resistance from springs, quite a bit more variety than just the pose you would do in yoga.
So a mat Pilates class, you're just working with your own body weight usually?
You are, yes, which sometimes people think it'll be easier because you don't have the equipment, but sometimes it's actually beneficial to have the equipment to help you with your own body weight.
And if you go into a Pilates studio, I've taken a couple of classes, it looks a little bit like a torture chamber if you don't know what you're looking at. There's something called a Cadillac that's pretty crazy.
Yes, yes. So I've been told that a lot, that it looks like a torture chamber. There's equipment with wood and springs and metal, but it's not that intimidating once you get started.
Well, what drew you into the Pilates world, Tracy, and how long have you been involved?
So I've been teaching for about 12 years. I come from a dance background, and that was one group that really took to Joseph Pilates' work back in New York when he was developing it. Dancers who had injuries and really wanted to get back in the game, and he was able to help them with that at a faster pace than other things that were available to them.
And it does seem like Pilates is popular with dancers. It doesn't bulk you up, right? It makes you long and lean?
Correct, yes.
But that doesn't mean men should shy away. Pilates classes I've taken, a lot of men have been in there.
Yes, and I have a lot of male clients, and they do definitely find the benefits, especially for their sports that they're playing. They get more range of motion, for example, for in golf. They're able to rotate more and hit the ball farther. So they have found the benefits, and they're sticking with it.
And how long has your studio been open?
For 9 years.
Right. Were you the first in town? I'm relatively new, only 2 years here, so I don't know the history of Pilates in this town.
There have been a couple people around, yeah. When I opened, it was one of the only studios that serviced full service equipment.
So if someone is new to Pilates, how should they start? Should they jump right into a group class or should they do a one-on-one?
I definitely recommend the one-on-one for sure. There's many ideas and principles that you would get more benefit from learning on that one-on-one. We have an introductory package, which gives it a better rate if you're more interested in just doing group classes, starting with that one-on-one. Also, we get to know your body as well. And you definitely get more out of having that one-on-one attention and getting that first idea of kind of where you stand and where you want to go from there.
Tempting maybe to dial it up on demand at home on your cable system because they have the Gaiam classes, but it's much better with an instructor, isn't it? Because there's a lot of breath that's involved.
There's a lot to it. There's breath, there's form, there's many people don't know where their bodies are in space. And they'll come in and say, oh, I've been doing this and this has been bugging me. I said, well, it's because you need to make this modification or this change. Wow, that feels a whole lot better. So oftentimes we don't quite have the awareness of where our bodies need to be, just as you may find in a golf lesson or a ski lesson. Oh, I didn't realize this was what I was doing wrong, and now this is a whole different experience.
So are you doing the exercises in front of a mirror, or do you videotape people? Do you actually show people how they have their bodies in that wrong place?
Well, it is beneficial. Sometimes I do take out my cell phone. Technology is great today. And sometimes if they see a picture or if they do look in the mirror, then they are gain that awareness. But really, when you're walking down the street and you have poor posture, you don't have a mirror there correcting you all the time. So you need to then learn where your body is in space, your proprioception, and be able to feel it so you can recreate it.
Is the Pilates business or market growing enough so that there's a demand for new teachers? And if someone's interested, how do they go through training to become a Pilates instructor?
Yes, definitely. Right now we are a little shorthanded, so I would say yes, we have demand for more instructors. It does take time and it's quite a process to get certified, especially at the level that we teach at. There it can take over a year for the process. It's a 600-hour comprehensive training and certification program. So it's quite an investment.
Is that done right here in town, or do you have to fly somewhere to?
There's three or four different schools in Salt Lake that do it. And then you'd have a test through our PMA, our Pilates Method organization.
And how is a Pilates class different from a bar class?
I can't speak too much to that. Obviously, with what we specialize at Range is we keep our group classes really small. We have four reformers, four chairs, four towers. So you're able to experience all of the equipment, but only with three other people at a time maximum, so that we still get to focus on you doing it right and getting the right posture and getting to know your own body.
And for the benefit of the newbies like me, what's the reformer?
So the reformer is one of the most popular pieces of equipment. It is controlled by springs. You may usually start laying down on your back, pushing your body weight against a foot bar, but there's lots of various exercises that you can do on it. Kind of have to see it to experience it.
So we could go on YouTube or somewhere and see people using the reformer.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. The feedback that I hear from people who take Pilates is that they feel like it is by far the most effective exercise they do when it comes to toning and changing their body. That you can do aerobic activity, you can lift weights, you can be a cyclist, you can be a skier. But Pilates really does head-to-toe reforming of your body and tightening it up.
Yes, there is many people in this town, for instance, are love their cardio. We love being out in the mountains and everything that we get to take advantage of it. But most of that is in one direction. You're pedaling forward, you're bicycling forward, you're hiking forward. You miss a whole range of motion in your body to keep you in balance, to keep you able to do these activities. So it's able to get you a little bit more mobile, a little bit stronger, not just the quads burning out constantly, but we're able to then bring your hamstring into it so that you're in balance, so that doesn't strain over time.
And speaking of range of motion, you also practice another technique with different equipment at your studio called gyrotonic, if
gyrotonic.
I'm pronouncing that
you
correctly.
You did, yes, yeah. Thank you.
Which was also developed by a dancer, it looks like.
Yes, he was a dancer. Joseph Pilates was not a dancer.
Oh, right.
But Giulio Horvath was a dancer.
Giulio Horvath from Romania.
Yes.
Yeah. And so what can you tell us about gyrotonic? What is it and how is that different from a Pilates practice?
Yes. So I'm the only one in town doing gyrotonic at this point. I really love it. It's a great range of motion exercise. It's a lot more fluid as well. So as you mentioned, yoga is a series of postures you hold. Pilates is a series of exercises you perform. Gyrotonic is even more fluid and you can connect one exercise right into the other. And it's more continuous motion. And then just the next thing on that spectrum would be dance, which would be, say, complete freedom of movement.
That sounds a little intimidating for someone who might not consider themselves a dancer.
Yes, and it really is not a prerequisite at all. And we can start very basic, but you get to move your body in space. And I think people appreciate that, especially here. You feel the freedom of swimming or the freedom of skiing and getting to move your body in all different directions. And so to be able to do that on the equipment where you really feel supported, where it holds your body weight in some positions so that you can really experience that range of motion without overstraining something.
Without naming names, can you tell us some tales about some of your biggest nightmare clients and then conversely some of your best clients? I mean, when somebody walks in and says X, I mean, what's a trigger for you to say, oh no, this is going to be a difficult person to work with?
Well, I think as you guys are expressing, wow, I don't know if I would be able to do that. There's a lot of fear of walking into a new activity. And you can see fear in people's body language, and you can see where they hold tension. And you can know over time, wow, I can, and I'm getting much better at this. I can see where you're energetically blocked, and I can see where you hold your tension, and how moving through it and also talking through it, I can be a bit of a therapist for people, can get these patterns to change and release and give you a lot of more freedom in your body.
How can you tell where somebody holds tension? What's an example of that?
I can watch it. You can see how people constantly shrug up their shoulders, or as they're trying to move their legs, suddenly their neck just pops out with tension. And there are different people who have studied this in length and can say, hey, if you have knee pain, that's because you have trouble with change and control. And so I've studied that quite a bit and also enjoy being able to, I can maybe guess what's going on in your life when I see your body.
So someone with knee pain is a control enthusiast, perhaps?
You know, I've been looking at people with knee stuff lately, and you can see that their hips don't move. And so all the pressure is being pushed down into that knee joint as they walk, as they hike. So getting a little bit more freedom and allowing them to move in their hips and be open to new things can be beneficial.
It's amazing to me how the body does carry a story along with it. I had an experience with a body worker in my former town who, just by holding her hand over my head, was able to tell that I'd taken a twisting fall to the right carrying something heavy the weekend before, and she was exactly right.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's amazing. Now, what part of your practice and Pilates and gyrotonic involves spirituality or energy work? Because in yoga, they're always talking about chakras and teachings from the Buddha in many classes. Is any of that tied in with the way you do either of your practices?
Well, I definitely have a spiritual practice of my own, and it is a big part of my own life. So it does carry over, but that doesn't always resonate with people as well. So you kind of have to give them baby spoonfuls and ways that it makes sense for them. And you may be speaking a different language, but you're saying the same thing. Right.
Right. How do you play music in the background in your sessions?
We do. We don't set anything to music, but often there's music in the background just for the ambiance.
Is it ambient music rather than spin class music?
Right. And it can vary. Sometimes it's just what I want to listen to at the time, right?
That's nice.
Yeah.
The one big roadblock I see to Pilates, Tracy, is the cost. It's mm-hmm. not inexpensive to take a Pilates class. Can you give our listeners an idea of how much you charge?
So my personal rate is $85 for a private session or $800 for 10. So it is $80 an hour to be with me if you're going to invest in the package. My other instructors are a little bit lower. They're at $75 or $70. And then our group classes are 29 when you're in that small group of four. And it's just a matter of looking at things differently. Everybody has their own budget and their own money, and they get to decide how they want to spend it and where they want to put it. And to me, this is what I enjoy, and this is what I love to do, making an investment in my body and my mind and my spirit. And it overflows into the rest of my life to bring more abundance to me in other ways as well.
And help our listeners understand the actual exercises. You are working up a sweat, but it's not like you're in that spin class where you're dripping wet by the end of the 45-minute session.
We're not a cardiovascular activity.
Yeah.
And cardiovascular activity tends to use major muscle groups, big muscles, to get your heart rate going, to give you an experience, right? And I'm not saying that's not great. I think that's wonderful, and I think we all need that. But if you do that all the time, you're missing out on a whole range of things your body needs as well. So, yes, it can be a good workout, but maybe if you're used to only doing cardio, it won't feel like the workout that you're used to, right?
One of the things that I notice with Pilates is you will do the exercise not at a high repetition level. It's maybe 6-8 times, at least the classes I took, and I thought, after finishing that round of exercises, how is that going to make a difference? It really does make a difference, though. Mm-hmm. And is that just because it's so focused what you're working on that muscle?
Yes, I also hear people, I rein them in and pull them back a little bit and make the motion smaller and use different muscles instead. And they're constantly surprised, wow, this is really small, but it's so much harder than that big motion I was doing. So it's just kind of wrapping your brain around doing things a little differently to get a better result.
Our previous guest has just written a book about child behavior, so that raises the question, we can make this a full circle, what age is minimum for Pilates, and do they do Pilates in the schools as sometimes they do yoga these days?
I don't think we're doing that currently in our community. It's definitely an option. We've worked a lot with teens, especially who are working on different sports. It can be great for self-confidence. And a lot of times finding an activity that they love. That one of the benefits to Pilates that you may also find with yoga is because you are so focused and we're telling you to work on your breath and to make these small controlled motions, everything else that's going on in your head gets put at bay for a little bit. which is a meditative quality, right? You're not sitting there meditating saying, I have to clear my mind. But by focusing on your breath, by your movement, you've just given your mind a break for an hour. That can be extremely beneficial.
And could someone who's 12 benefit from this, or do you need to be more like 16?
There is no minimum age. I think it depends for every parent and every child to decide, yes, I like this and I'm seeing the benefits. And sometimes the younger ones are some of our tougher clients, as you asked what may be more challenging, but it's making a connection. There are many instructors in town. We have several at my studio, and you have to find the person that's right for you, that speaks your language.
Right. What's the best time of day to practice Pilates? Does it depend on the individual?
It depends on the individual. You know, for me personally, having been a dancer, when I was in high school, I was used to dancing every night after school. I went to college, and all our classes were at 10 a.m., it was a huge shift for me, but then I got used to that, right? So whatever works in your schedule and your own personal clock, that you're going to get the most benefit. Be open to trying new times. You may be surprised, but you'll probably find what you need.
When I first moved to town 4 years ago, I was looking for a Pilates class, and all the times I wanted were full.
Yeah.
It seems like everybody up here loves Pilates, and it was hard to get into a class. Do you find that's true at Range? Are your classes filled?
Yes, they are right now. It goes through we're a little cyclical here in town, but certainly if you have other people you're interested in, if we can get an instructor to do the time we want, we will make it happen.
So we've got about 30 seconds left, Tracy. Anything else you want our listeners to know about Pilates?
Well, our website is rangeparkcity.com. We teach both Pilates and gyrotonic, and as we said, it's definitely mind, body, and spirit beneficial, so check us out.
That's fantastic. Maybe I'll be calling you. Or I'll refer you to my friends. Refer my friends to you.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Tracy from Range Pilates, for being here this morning. You're listening to The Mountain Life. We'll be right back after these messages.
For adventurers on a budget, the Utah Olympic Park offers a host of activities at no charge. Admission and parking are always free. Start with a tour of the Alf Engen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Winter Games Museum. Best of all, come support athletes from all over the world who train at the park. Open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Details available at UtahOlympicLegacy.org.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities, and a KPCW supporter.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Renee Bodley, here with my co-host Dave Cushing. I'm filling in for Lynn Ware Peak this morning. Man, those are big shoes to fill, Dave.
Lynn is the master, and I'm filling in for Tim Henney, another guru of mountain living.
We are coming up on NPR News. That's just in a few seconds, but real quick, a last check on our weather. We're looking for a high of 82 degrees today, mostly sunny, about a 20% chance of thunderstorms. Then tonight, low of 52 degrees. Then tomorrow on Thursday, it's going to be a high of 84. We want to thank our guest, Dr. Stuart Shanker, and Tracy Powers, NPR News is now.